Happy Father's Day. How do you feel today? Are you pumped? Scared? Maybe you're just sad. Maybe you're grateful. Whatever it is, those things are all appropriate when it comes to Father's Day. I find myself in a very new, kind of exciting space on Father's Day. On the one hand, it's now been a little more than 2 years since my own father died. And, you know, having been 2 years, now I'm in a place where I can, you know, I can reflect on his life. I can bring things into my own life. I can think about his impact on me in a way that's different than those first couple of years when grief is kind of more, a little more raw, a little more in the front. So that's been cool. But on the other hand, I'm in the process of watching my own son become a father. Like, literally, today is the due date. So if you see Anne go up the aisle, you know, you'll know what's happening. And so, but that has me thinking about generations and lineage and things like that in ways that I really haven't. I really haven't had to or been able to this point. And so today, I've decided I'm going to spare you any parenting advice, okay? I stopped giving parenting advice, back when I had children, right? Like, before that, I had lots of really good parenting advice. But surely, by the time my own kids were toddlers, I just decided I should probably just back off for now. Okay, so, but today what I can do is offer you some biblical counsel. You know, some words from the very greatest volume, the greatest collection of wisdom amassed in human history. We call it the Bible, the Scriptures. And we're going to go to a place in the Scriptures today that we don't usually spend a lot of time. We're going to be in the book of 2 Kings, which is in your Old Testament. So you can run around and look at that. What we're going to see today is, well, something that we probably all know, either literally or either it's right in front or it's just sort of intuitive. And it's this, that fathers make a tremendous impact on their children, but also on their children's children. And not just that, on the children of their children's children. And on it goes. A family is blessed that has a good father. A family that doesn't have a father present or isn't in good relationship, they struggle. It's hard. And that's all we're going to see, those kinds of things in the book of 2 Kings. Now, 2 Kings takes place in a section of history. It's actually a history book. It tells the story of the kings of the people of Israel. And there's two volumes. We're going to be in the second volume today. And what we're going to see today is four generations of kings. Actually, four in the nation of Israel, four in the nation of Judah. Because when we get to our story in 2 Kings chapter 12, what we think of as the people of Israel, they've actually been divided by civil war into two nations, one in the north, one in the south. Israel in the north, Judah in the south. And so we're going to see four kings that ruled and reigned at the same time, that they overlapped each other over a period of almost 100 years. And it's going to be about 835 to 735 BC. That's the time frame that we're talking about, okay? And even though it's ancient, even though it goes way back, what you're going to see is the incredible lesson, the wisdom that it teaches us about fathers. And when we're done, I'm going to draw out three, what I think are really important points for us to take home with us today, okay? So this time period, 700-800 BC, it's a brutal time. It's a time of constant warfare. It's catapults and sieges and spears and shields and all kinds of stuff. It's also a very tumultuous time spiritually for the people of God. This is a time of prophets. And so people that you may have heard of, Elijah, Elisha, Joel, Jonah, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, they all had an impact during this time period that we're going to look at today. It's a time of treachery, it's a time of assassinations, it's a time of family members killing other family members, heads showing up in baskets, all kinds. It's very Game of Thrones, really. It's what it is. And it illustrates the impact that fathers can have. So 2 Kings chapter 12, that's where we're going to start. And as we go, we'll highlight for you, there's three statements that I really want you to record. If you're a note taker, there's three things to write down today that you're going to see as we go. All right? Okay, so 2 Kings chapter 12 starts in verse 1. Our first king in the story, his name is going to be Joash. It says this, in the seventh year of Jehu, Joash became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 40 years. His mother's name was Zebiah. She was from Beersheba. So his name was Joash. Now, the thing about Joash is, Joash's father had been king. Now, get this. His father was king, but his father died. And when his father died, his grandmother seized the throne, okay? She would actually be the only queen in the history of Judah, right? So she seizes the throne, and she kills all her family members so she could stay queen. She kills her children, their spouses, and her grandchildren, except for this one little guy who was rescued by a distant relative who was married to a priest. So they rescued him, little Joash. He was a year old, maybe. And they hid him away for a long time. And eventually, after some years, they led this revolt against the queen, and he would be king. But this leads us really to our first, you know, important principle to take home today. Watch out for grandma, right? That's, okay. All right, not really. So Joash is held in hiding for 6 or 7 years. He's about 7 years old when this revolt happens. The queen is kicked out, and he becomes king. He's just a little guy, right? And so what you're going to read here in these next couple of verses is going to be a setup. We're going to see these words repeat themselves over and over again because it gives you the biblical perspective on the kingship of these people. Does that make sense? Look at verse 2. This is talking about little Joash once he becomes king. It says, Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years Jehoiada the priest instructed him. That was the priest who rescued him. Okay, that little phrase, though, is super important. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Every single one of these kings is going to have this summary at the very beginning of his reign. It's going to say something like this. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, which means, for the most part, he followed the ways of God. He believed and he followed the ways of God. Okay? Now, he wasn't perfect, though. Look at verse 3. We're going to see this statement more than once, too. The high places, however, were not removed. The people continued to offer sacrifices and burn incense there. The high places refer to literally high places, places in the hills, places out around the perimeter of the land, places that had belonged to other religious groups, other religious practices, places where pagan gods were worshipped, idols were set up, all kinds of profane practices occurred. And when the Hebrew people came into the land, if they didn't take down these high places, they remained. And eventually, people would start doing goofy stuff there. The people of Israel, the people of God, would start setting up idols. They'd start worshiping pagan gods. They'd start doing all kinds of profane things. So this is a significant statement. When the writer says, but the high places were not removed. He was good. He did what was right. He followed God. But there was this one little nagging thing. He's not perfect, which that's okay. I want you to take that today to know, dads, this isn't about perfection. Right? This isn't a call for you to be perfect. This is a call for you to recognize that the eyes of God are on you. So he did what was right. The high places remained. And then what we're going to do is jump down to the very end of his life. The next several verses tell about some of the things that he did. But there's a summary, a conclusion that starts in verse 19. And it says this, as for the other events of the reign of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? And the answer is yes. That's the biblical writer's way of saying, if you want the details, like there's a history book in the library you can read. But the writer of Kings is interested in a theological perspective on these kings. And so it's a little different. Okay? So verse 20 says this, his officials conspired against him. They assassinated him at Beth Milo on the road down to Selah. The officials who murder him, they had these really funny names, right? You can read them there. They're hard to pronounce. And then it says he died and he was buried with his ancestors in the city of David. And here's what I want you to see. Amaziah, his son, succeeded him. That's another very significant statement. At the sum total, the end of his life and reign, what happens is his son succeeds him. Okay, and we're going to catch up with this son in a minute. But here's a little summary. Joash, he's one of the kings of Judah, the first of four, we're going to see. He did what was right. That was the description of his reign. And at the end, his son succeeded him. Okay? So then, we're going to jump over into Israel. A new king comes to power in Israel. And let's meet him in chapter 13. This is verse 1. His name is Jehoahaz. Jehoahaz. He becomes king during Joash's reign. That's why it says it this way. In the 23rd year of Joash, son of Ahaziah, who was the king of Judah, Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 17 years. And verse 2 gives the summary of his reign. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, you see, that's the opposite of what we saw from the kings of Judah. He did evil. That's the sum total description of his reign. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord by following the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit, and he did not turn away from them. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, is like the poster child for an evil king. Okay, he set up and encouraged, actually pushed the people to worship other gods. He set up golden calves for people to worship. He did all kinds of profane things. So whenever the Bible says, you know, somebody was like Jeroboam, that's their way of saying really, really evil. Okay? And so that's what this king here, the first in the line of four in Israel, that's the summary statement about his life. And as a result, the scriptures say that the king of Aram persecuted and oppressed these people for years and years and years. But let's jump down to verse 8 and see the end of his line. As for the other events of the reign of Jehoahaz and all that he did and all his achievements, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Israel? Yes, they are. Verse 9, Jehoahaz rested with his ancestors, was buried in Samaria, and Jehoash, his son, succeeded him as king. Right? Same thing. Same story. We've seen this before. Right? Here's Jehoahaz, king of Israel. He did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and his son succeeded him. All right, now we're going to jump ahead. We're going to look at verse 10. This is going to be that son, Jehoash, in Israel. He took Jehoahaz's place, and his reign is described in verse 10. It says, in the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, became king of Israel. I don't expect you to remember these names, by the way. King in Samaria, he reigned 16 years. Verse 11, he did what? Evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn away from any of the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he caused Israel to commit. He continued in them. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He continued in his father's footsteps of worshiping golden calves. Notice the end to his record down in verse 12. As for the other events of the reign of Jehoash, did all that he did and his achievements, including his war against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Israel? And here it comes, verse 13. Jehoash rested with his ancestors, and Jeroboam succeeded him on the throne. Jehoash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. What happened at the end of his reign? His son succeeded him. Right? He did evil. He followed his father's example and practice, and his son succeeds him. All right, now let's jump over to chapter 14. We're going to go back to the lines of the kings of Judah. We've seen one, but we're going to pick up the account of Amaziah in chapter 14, verse 1. Notice what it says. In the second year of Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, son of Joash, the king of Judah, he began to reign. Verse 2. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Jehoadin, or something like that, and she was from Jerusalem. Verse 3, here it comes. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. But not as his father David had done. In everything, he followed the example of his father Joash. Two important things there. First is this pattern that we've seen. There's a summary. The person either does right or they do evil in the eyes of the Lord.
And here, the son of Joash who did right in the eyes of the Lord, he also does what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Although the writer wants you to know he wasn't perfect. He wasn't as great as his father, David, right? David is his ancestor, and David is the poster child for a great king. He was the man after God's own heart, right? Jeroboam's the poster child for an evil king over here. But he was good. He wasn't perfect, but that's not our goal. In everything, this is the third important statement. He followed the example of his father, Joash. Okay? So you might want to jot that down. He followed the example. But verse 4 says, the high places remained. The high places, however, were not removed. The people continued to offer sacrifices and to burn incense there. So although he did what was right, there's this little nagging issue we're going to come back to in a minute of the high places, people still worshiping in ways that God didn't want them to, okay, out there in the high places. All right, let's read his postscript for Amaziah, verse 17. Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, he lived for 15 years after the death of Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. As for the other events of Amaziah's reign, are they not written in the books of the annals of the kings of Judah? Yes, they are. Verse 19, they conspired against him in Jerusalem. He fled to Lachish, but they sent men after him to Lachish and killed him there. And down in verse 21, it says, then all of the people of Judah, they took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and made him king in place of his father, Amaziah. So this king, he suffers a violent death. He gets killed. But the same thing is the sum total of his life. His son succeeds him on the throne. Right? So, you know, we see kings of Israel who do evil in the eyes of the Lord, and their son follows them. We see kings in Judah, they do what's right in the eyes of the Lord, and their sons follow them as well. Okay? So, Amaziah takes the throne after his father had been assassinated, and he has this reign that's described simply as he succeeded his father, and his father succeeds him. All right, we're going to go back to Israel. We're going to catch up with Jehoahaz's son, Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam, this is Jeroboam II. He's named after Jeroboam, who is the poster child for an evil king. So how do you think it's going to go with Jeroboam? Yeah, not so good, not so good. This is chapter 14, verse 23. In the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn away from any of the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. So here's the same thing. He did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. As far as God was concerned, where it counted, he was a failure. He was a failure. And this is despite the fact that Jeroboam was actually an extremely successful king politically or militarily. He conquered a lot of land. He restored the borders of Israel. He was very successful in that sense. Verse 25 points to that. He was the one who restored the boundaries of Israel from Lebo Hamath to the Dead Sea in accordance with the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, spoken through his servant Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet from Gath-Hepher. That's the Jonah you're familiar with, maybe with the boat and a fish and all of that. He had prophesied that someday there'd be a king who would expand again the boundaries to their original parameters. And this king does that. However, he also does what is evil in the eyes of the Lord, and that's the summary of his life. And knows what it says in verse 29. Jeroboam rested with his ancestors, the kings of Israel, and Zechariah, his son, succeeded him as king. His son succeeded him. Starting to see this pattern here. It's going to be said of every single one of these kings. His son is going to succeed him. All right, let's shift back to Judah. This is Azariah. He's the son of Amaziah. His name is Azariah. He's also called Uzziah, in case your translation says that, if you're reading along. He was also a very successful king, and it says this in verse 1, in the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, son of Amaziah, king of Judah, he began to reign. Verse 2, he was 16 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem 52 years. His mother's name was something kind of hard to pronounce, and she was from Jerusalem. Here it is. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. here it is again, just as his father Amaziah had done. Do you see the pattern? He did what was right because his father had done what was right. He followed his father's example. Okay? There's this nagging little issue, though, that still remains with the high places. Verse 4. The high places, however, they were not removed. The people continued to offer sacrifice and burn incense there. And just like the others, we'll see how his reign ended. Verse 6. As for the other events of Azariah's reign and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Judah? Yes. Verse 8. Or the next verse. It says, Azariah rested with his ancestors. He was buried with them in the city of David, and Jotham, his son, succeeds him as king. His son does follow him, even though he does evil in the eyes of the Lord. All right, let's jump down all the way to 2 Kings 15. You see what's happening, the parallel lines here. Let's look down at verse 8. This is Zechariah. He's going to be the final king in this line. In the 38th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Zechariah, son of Jeroboam, became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned only 6 months. And this is probably why he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, as his predecessors has done. Now, that word predecessors, it's the same as the word fathers. So this means he did evil not just like his father, but like his father's father and his father's father's father, right? This whole line of kings, he was just like them. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. And so it's like God said, okay, that's enough. And he only reigned 6 months, right? And his son does not succeed him. Finally, God's done with that line. All right, look all the way down at verse 32, and we'll pick up the last king on the side of Judah. This is Jotham. It says about him that in the second year of Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, began to reign. And here's the summary of his life. He was 25 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem 16 years. His mother's name was Jerusha, daughter of Zadok. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father Uzziah, or Azariah as we know him, had done. Just as his father had done. And now look at verse 38. Unlike Zechariah, his son does succeed him. He rested with his ancestors, was buried with them in the city of David, the city of his father. And Ahaz, his son, succeeded him as king. His son succeeded him as king. And that brings our story to an end. And you're thinking, I'm so glad because we've been in school all year. We finally get out of school, and now I come to church, and you're making me learn our history lesson. But here's what I want you to see today. You see what this account tells us about the tremendous impact we make on our children and on our children's children? There are no guarantees in parenting. I promise you that. There are absolutely no guarantees. But here are three things that you can count on. Okay? The first is this. Your example will be followed. Right? Over and over again, we saw that key statement, just as his father had done. And that should grip your heart. It's not a coincidence the way these family lines went. There's always exceptions, but we see in these four successive generations that were parallel in the family line where they did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, their sons followed their example. And in the family line where they did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, their sons followed their example. And people tell me that my children, you know, they look like me or they have mannerisms like me, and that's all true. But what the Bible is showing us is something much deeper than that. It's talking about your values, your character, your faith, and how those things get caught by our children or by those that we mentor or by those that we coach, by those that we teach, right? My dishwasher and I are currently locked in an epic struggle to the death. It's like two warriors in mortal combat. The dishwasher breaks something, and I try to fix it, and then the dishwasher does something new that's broken, and I try to fix that, and back and forth we go. And so two Saturdays ago, I found myself sitting on a chair staring at my dishwasher. Why? because that's what my dad would have done. I'll bet like a lot of your dads, my dad had a saying, right? If a job's worth doing, it's worth doing right. But for my dad, that meant it's worth doing slowly. And this used to drive me crazy. Now, one time when my kids were little and we lived in Missouri, we moved into this new house, so we had this garage that was a clean slate, perfect, nothing in it. And my mom and dad were coming to visit, and my dad always liked to have a project to do so that he wouldn't go stir crazy sitting around the house. And so I said, "Dad, this would be great. New garage. Would you build garage shelves in this garage?" And he was like, "Yeah, sure." I'm like, "Okay, you've only got a few days you're going to be here, but if you could do that, that would really help me out. I would love that." Great. So first day, we make a plan. I go off to work. I come back from work at the end of the day, and there's my dad. This is a true story. He's in a folding lawn chair sitting looking at the wall of my garage. And I'm like, "Really?" Day two, I get up, I go to work, I come home at the end of the day, my dad is in the exact same chair, same spot, he's looking at the wall, except now he has a pad of paper, graph paper. My dad loved graph paper. And I'm like, "You gotta be kidding me, I guess we're not gonna do this." Day three, I get up, I go to work, I come back not expecting anything, and poof, there it is, the perfect garage shelf system. Because that's how my dad did it. He would sit and stare and think and contemplate and cover every possibility before he acted. And it drove me crazy, but now that I'm getting older, I'm beginning to appreciate that. And it's making its way into my life. And that's what the scriptures are telling us. Your character, your values, your example, it's going to be followed. And that's why we pursue discipleship. That's why we keep after God. That's why we keep letting Him form us and shape us from the inside out. It's not the things that you do and experience early in your life that will have the biggest impact on your kids. It's as they grow, it's as you grow. And they're more likely to follow the end of the road than the beginning of the road. You're being watched. Your example is going to be followed. Okay, the second big thing is you will be succeeded. Okay? Just accept it. Deal with it. You will be succeeded. Every single one of these kings, all eight of them, it said the same thing about them, right? There came a point when their reign was over and they were succeeded by a child. And that's true for all of us. And I don't tell you that to depress you. I tell you that to encourage you because it gives you a vision and a focus for what your job really is. Your children are going to come after you. The people that you teach are going to rise up and become the teachers. Those high school students that you mentor in the youth group, they're going to become the mentors. You see, that's how it works. That's how God wants it to work. You will be succeeded. And that gives us a vision for us to be the kind of people that allows that to happen. Every one of these kings went out. Some of them went the easy way, some of them went the hard way. But in all the cases, they were succeeded. So have you ever seen the documentary Yiro Dreams of Sushi? Anybody seen that? Oh, yes. It's a great movie. You should go look it up on Netflix. It's about an 85-year-old sushi master in Japan. Okay, he operates a Michelin three-star restaurant, which is really 10 counter seats at a subway station where you have to pay at least $300 to eat. There's no menu. He tells you what you're going to eat. But he's a master sushi chef, and he's in this relentless pursuit of perfection. So it's a really interesting story. But it also tells the story of his son. His oldest son, obligated, obliged by their culture to succeed his father, works in the restaurant, but he's 50 years old. And he's a master sushi chef in his own right. But his dad won't get out of the way. His dad is so focused on developing the perfect sushi that he's got this 50-year-old son who all he does is wash, prep, prepare. And you can see when you watch the movie, the angst in his life. Right? Listen, the kings are telling us, if you want to be successfully succeeded, you got to start making room now. In fact, if we had time, we could go through these accounts and I could show you how so many of these kings, they had their sons start to reign before they were dead. They were co-regents. They brought them in and they mentored them and they gave them experience and they taught them how to do it before they died. And there's a lesson in there for us that our kids are going to succeed us, and we'd best make room for them. All right, here's the third thing. Your high places matter. Your high places matter. Those places out on the periphery, the places that aren't the places where God rules and reigns and lives, has his way, those places matter. Because the truth is, if we went on in the book of 2 Kings, you would see that both of these lines of kings, ultimately, they both ultimately passed away. Actually, God removed them. God took the people into captivity because they kept worshiping other gods. The high places were never fully removed. There was always an opening. There was always a place for the people to go worship something besides God. And you and me, we have our high places, don't we? We have those places in our lives, in our hearts, where God isn't the one we worship. And those things, eventually, they will bring you down. And I mean that in the sense that your example is going to be passed on. And if there's one thing I've learned over the years from watching people, is it's that the things that we hold in secret, the things we think are in secret, they get passed on to our kids too. We think we are hiding them, but they don't. And so my encouragement to you today would be to say, listen, that's the purpose. That's one of the main reasons that we come together in community and we seek God. It's so that we can take the high places in our life and bring them back under God's reign and rule. And so whatever your high place may be, maybe it's the anger in your life that you indulge. Maybe it's the appetite that you have, the thing you're indulging in, the stuff you're doing that's over the line, over the limit, right? Maybe it's the bitterness in your heart that you haven't resolved, maybe because of your own relationships in your family. Maybe it's envy and the way you can't look at someone else without wanting what they have. Whatever it could be. You're not going to effort your way out of this. You're not going to try your way out of your high places. You have to bring those high places back under the Lord and let him shape you. Let him transform you from the inside out. And when we do that, we become the kinds of examples and the kinds of people that we want to be to pass on to those coming after us. The reality is the very best example that we can give to our children is to say, I'm sorry. It is to acknowledge our weakness. It's to be vulnerable with them and recognize the places where we have misstepped, where we have failed them even. And that in and of itself becomes an example for them. As you show them that you're bringing your high places back underneath the Lord's domain, they will be encouraged to do the same in their lives. Because your high places, they really do matter. Okay, so for those of you here that aren't fathers, maybe you're connected to fathers. Maybe you're married to one. Maybe you're in a relationship with one. Maybe you have the role of cheering them on. Let me just encourage you today to do that. That the very best thing we can do for the fathers, for the teachers, for the mentors, for the coaches in our lives is cheer them on and encourage them. And I wish I had time to tell you today of the transforming power of my wife's words of encouragement in my life and the way that she's able to speak in ways that encourage and move and help me move on. I've had men in my life who serve that very same role, who call out, who remind me, who keep me on the journey of bringing the high places under the Lord's domain. And it's a good thing, and it's one of the reasons we exist together as a community. And that's something you can do to help someone. And the final thing I want you to say, my heart today, fathers, is not for you to go away from this feeling guilty. I think all of us have a sense of we'd like to be better fathers, that we are in this together. And I want to encourage you that way and say perfection is impossible. It isn't really the goal. The goal is to be people who are taking steps closer, nearer to Jesus every day. Because it is in that process that he changes us. He shapes us to be loving and gracious and forgiving and strong and wise, all of those things that we want to be for those who come after us. That's the road that we're on together. And let me urge you in that direction, all right? So your example will be followed. You will be succeeded. Your high places, they really do matter. Let's pray today. God, thanks for the examples of the kings. Thanks that even though they are so far in the past, they still speak to us today because of those universal truths about our examples, about succession, and about the high places. And God, my prayer today is that you would grip our hearts, that you would let the scriptures dwell in us and shape us. And most importantly, God, I pray that for each of us, you would help us, that you would reveal to us, help us to be honest about the high places in our life. And instead of covering them up or instead of knocking ourselves out, trying to figure it out ourselves, that we would again take that high place and bring it to you and say, this is your place, Lord. That this area of my life, this habit, this thing, I'm going to bring it under your control. And you show me what to do. And thank you for your grace, the grace that shines the light in the dark places, the light that roots out the shame that we sometimes experience, the frustrations we can even have as we try so hard. Strengthen our hearts today, God. Remind us of your grace and give us your courage. In Jesus' name, amen.